Thank you. Okay. I'm Ash Raman from Taylor Fry. So this session has undergone a change. Is anyone here expecting to hear about the WANDIS? The person from the WANDIS is not here. For those who are in the know a little bit, or perhaps a lot, there is currently a negotiation going on. The current parliament and the current government in WA came into power saying they were going to go back to the have the same scheme as everyone else, back to the national NDIS. That is still an ongoing negotiation. So while I think there was a wish from the person who was coming over, Michael Carroll, that he could stand here and talk about the rollout, because as it stands, the WANDIS is still undergoing a rollout. He's unable to do so simply because, besides the pressures there, I think the uncertainty, it was perhaps put a stop to too many public statements. Then somehow yesterday he said he wasn't going to come and be able to do it, but I could do it. So to fill you in, I'm one of the actuaries. As of when I found that out today, I suggested that's probably not appropriate. Firstly, I've seen your presentation. I don't necessarily agree with everything in the presentation, but but I am there more than happy if, because there's some of you here that are interested, when Chris is done, and he'll be given essentially the whole hour if he wants it. But if there is time remaining, I don't have data at my fingertips, but if people actually have questions on the WANDIS, I can answer them the best I can, as long as you note that I'm their independent actuary, so the actual internal mechanisms of it I can't comment on. All I can comment on is the view of what are the risks associated with the scheme, and that may be applicable, if you like, more broadly to the national scheme, if you want to ask along those lines. But without actually any prompting information in front of you, I do expect those questions to be few. But they are available to you if you want. If you feel particularly disappointed by Michael's absence, he apologises. He does wish he could come. But the scheme will be presentation will be no less forward anyway, because I'm sure the WA is well represented here in the workers' compensation field, and it'll be very interesting. We've got Chris White speaking for us today. He's been acting CEO since January 2007. Chris is managing General Manager of Legislation and Scheme Information, and has more than 30 years' experience in workers' compensation and occupational safety and health policy in Western Australia. Mr. White has held senior policy and management roles at both WorkCover WA and WorkSafe WA. He holds a Masters of Arts in Public Policy and from Murdoch University. So if you could all put your hands together for Chris White.
Thank you, Ash, and thank you all for coming. So I thought I'd use the opportunity today to draw a few contrasts with some of the material you would have heard from some of the other scheme regulators and scheme operators, and try and call out some of the distinctives of the WA scheme, because there are some significant points of contrast, both in terms of our history and our performance, but also our design that might be of interest as we go forward. So this is what I intend to cover, just to labour the point of difference about our privately underwritten status of our scheme and how that works in practice, perhaps relative to some of the other regulators you've heard from. Do that by comparison and talk about ourselves. Scheme performance, our recent and long-term performance, our legislative agenda, and then some of the issues which we're facing and contemplating and working with our stakeholders in taking the scheme forward. So this is a well-practiced chart, a well-used chart in WA to try and communicate to people the challenges of workers' compensation on a national scale. So this shows you the distinction between the privately underwritten and centrally underwritten schemes, and shows some relative sizes in terms of premium income. And these are the CPM, Safe Work Australia figures in terms of, and the, so you've got premium income and 10 day or more claim numbers. So in the privately underwritten space, we're by far the largest of the jurisdictions, and I apologise to Bill because ACT has somehow got missed off there. Thankfully he's not here. Don't anybody tell him. They are sensitive and say they should be, and I do apologise. We have another version of this chart, which I haven't got, which shows you the common law, the treatment of common law status in each of the jurisdictions. And so you overlay the two with the way common law is treated, the funding mechanisms, and there's just the variations across the state are writ large. And in the West, we have a lot of people who come from the East and hear the name WorkCover and think that we are an insurer. And so we are constantly positioning ourselves as pretty much a pure regulator, similar to the other privately underwritten jurisdictions. But because of our size and the nature of our scheme, we do have a distinctive approach to regulation that's emerged over time. Relative size, our scheme, that's the latest CPM figures. I think our scheme has rolled off in terms of size, and I think we're below $1 billion in terms of premium income going forward. But in terms of relativities, the relative size is still pretty accurate there. Privately underwritten again, theme for the first part of my presentation. These are our insurers, and so again, to labour the point, insurers are insurers in our scheme. They're not agents of WorkCover, they are independent insurers and have all the freedoms, such as it were, that go with that. And I might just pause on our regulatory approach there in terms of the status of insurers and self-insurers. We license the insurers, we set a recommended premium rate, and we largely leave them alone from there. We don't have claims manuals. We don't inject WorkCover's thoughts and processes in terms of claim management, how they should manage their claims, how they should run their return to work processes. We are outcome driven, and we hope, well, we trust and believe that the insurers compete not only on price, they can charge the premium they like within certain bands, but also on service and the responsiveness to their client base. And that is the driver, the underpinning fundamentals of our scheme, is that competition element between insurers and to a lesser extent self-insurers. Our number of self-insurers is declining. We, again, have a very unregulated premium underwriting model, so we've had burner retro policies in our scheme for a very long time, and the marginal difference of the benefits of self-insurance versus a retro-type policy are very marginal these days, so no new self-insurer entrants and a number dropping out to join the conventional insurance market. Who is WorkCover in this scheme? We are four key areas. We're active managers and stewards of the scheme. We're not involved in claims. We're not involved in the process of the acceptance, the liability, all those sorts of issues are left to the insurers. But we are very active on the softer side of regulation in terms of how the scheme operates, the behaviours of the various parties, and the way in which they work. So we own the Act. We manage the Act, and I'll have a bit more to say about that in a moment. But policy is very important in our scheme because there's a lot of soft policy work that goes on to keep the scheme on the straight and narrow. In a regulatory sense, we license insurers, service providers and other parties and have a very strong regulatory regime in terms of performance standards and requirements then. But also, again, once you're in our scheme and licensed, WorkCover, apart from signing up to the health benefits of work, the clinical framework, we leave the professionals in both the treatment space and other areas to set their own standards and live or die in a commercial sense, quality of the services they offer. Dispute resolution is the one area where we do directly provide services. So within WorkCover is a conciliation and arbitration services, two separate services, but managed together. And that is an independent, quasi-independent dispute resolution service, which is our frontline service delivery in terms of our interaction with workers and employers, and the legal profession is primarily in that dispute resolution context. So unlike other jurisdictions where dispute resolution lives outside of the regulator, in Western Australia, that's part of our organisation and is independent because we have no stake in the claims. We don't have any investment in the outcome of a decision, so we're able to manage that in-house. Whereas other regulators who have some more active stance at the claim level might find that difficult. It works very well in Western Australia. And I'll talk a bit about the stats in a moment. And education in terms of bringing stakeholders and parties up to speed with the way in which the scheme has worked. The complexity, the theme of complexity we've heard from a number of quarters is a real challenge to us in terms of our legislation and the way in which it's been drafted and the statutory requirements, which are well out of date. And so there's a lot of activity in the education area. On to a few charts now in terms of performance, and for better or worse, this is the headline average recommended premium rates. So there's a few talking points here. One is stability is a theme of our scheme in terms of performance. The last major reform of any kind, of any substance in our scheme, was 2004-05. Since then, the benefit structure hasn't changed, or if it has, it's only marginally increased. We removed any age limits on entitlements in 2012, and then we reformed our dispute resolution arrangements in that year as well. But effectively, it's a level playing field in terms of the design of the scheme, the operation of the scheme, who's who. Nothing has changed over that period. So we are, it's a pretty positive result using that measure in terms of the way in which the scheme has gone. Premium rates are bumping along the bottom now, I would think. I think we've reached our structural sort of limit. It's hard to see them going much lower in terms of the cost structures which we work with. But it's a pretty good outcome when, back when the modern era started, it was close to 3%. And premium rates have come down very well after initial set of reforms, 1999 and then 2004, a very stable and enduring scheme. The other thing to point out is this is our average recommended rate. The actual paid rate is 10 to 15% lower than this rate across in aggregate. Insurers in our scheme can discount the recommended rate for an industry class by as much as they like, and they can charge up to 75% loading without the approval of WorkCover. And they can charge well above that if they need to, subject to obtaining approval. So the recommended and actual rates are somewhat different and reflect competition within our scheme. So a benefit to employers is the design element, which keeps insurers on their toes because they've got to compete for market share and compete for the composition of their portfolio in terms of the risk they obtain and buy. The single most distinctive performance issue in our scheme in recent times has been the dramatic reduction in the number of claims. I've been going to all of the scheme updates, and most schemes have got a downward trend which is levelling off. I don't think we've levelled off yet. So this is a four-year time span, a 20% reduction in just in the aggregate number of claims, which is a big shift in a small period of time. If you go back further, you don't have to go back very far. For EMU youth, it was 40,000. And I'm very fond of saying when I first joined the Work Safety Workers Compensation world, there are 80,000 claims in the WA scheme on an annual basis, and that was in the late 80s, early 90s, and since then the number of claims has come down. Most of the action in the recent times has been in the no time lost end of the spectrum, but in terms of service providers, just the amount of activity in our scheme, a 20% reduction in the overall number of claims in that short space of time is having a material impact on a whole range of things. And for actuaries, payment per claim handled, payment per claim, whatever, have all been thrown tipped up because of the secular change in the composition of our claims. And so that has been presented a few challenges for our board and others to understand what's happening in our scheme, because the average cost has shot through the roof. But of course, that's because the lower cost, no cost claims are disappearing out of the pool. And there's some evidence or some early signs of some stability. We're starting to have less month on month or quarter on quarter change, but mostly then still negative. And most recent numbers have us, our claim numbers running at 6% less on an annual basis at the end of 16-17, and the trend hasn't completely finished yet. Expresses a frequency rate that just reflects the trends that we were seeing. So the other interesting part of the performance of the WA scheme is we've come off the back of a boom, and quite a few expectations of doom and gloom of a crash in wages and employment. Well, that hasn't really happened. The wage levels have definitely come off, but they haven't fallen off a cliff, as it were, and so the stability is continuing pretty well. The 15-16 number has always struck me as odd. There's no ABS people in the room. Labour force figures that year, not too sure about for WA. Easy excuse, but we seem back on trend in terms of the downward decline, because the number of claims continues to fall over that period, and wages have been fairly stable in hours worked. I suppose it's true of all schemes. A large proportion of medical-only and short-duration claims. This breaks up the composition of our claims, and when we look at our lost time claims, which is still one day or shift or more, That balance has shifted quite a bit to that the long duration claims, which are our 60-day or more, has grown as proportion of lost time claims, as you can see, by 14%, but a big reduction in the short duration, which, as I say, is a whole lot of familiar metrics have had quite a bit of shift in a short space of time, and it's been a challenge to interpret that and understand what it means for our scheme. Those numbers are a bit skewy. Return to work, other key measure. You know, others might comment, and others have, that our, in a compensation and return to work balance, our scheme is probably skewed more to the compensation end than return to work end, in terms of the way in which we resolve claims, and I'll come to that in a moment. And our investment, as it were, in return to work, pretty limited relative to other schemes in terms of the investment, in terms of we don't have a return to work inspectorate. We have a pretty benign set of requirements on employers in terms of obligations to take workers back. Pretty soft sort of environment there. The interesting thing, in a policy sense, is our outcomes are comparable to the other jurisdictions. That might say more about the measures, and there is a conversation about those headline return to work measures. They don't change much from time to time, and they don't seem particularly sensitive. But at face value, in any given survey period, we're just above or just below the national average and very comparable, and have not had to make or don't make the investment that other schemes have made with seemingly very comparable results. Not sure if that's a convenient interpretation of where we got to, but it is on the surface, that's what the data suggests. So the next round of the national survey is in May next year. We're lining up for that, and there's some tweaking of the survey instrument. These headline rates will continue, I hope, or I'll be very keen that they do. And some more work to be done on the value of investment in return to work, I think, for many schemes. Cheap shot. This is another flavour of what's happened. Our return to work status at the point of exit has come down a little, and but not dramatically so, and it's a very underdeveloped 2016-17 there in terms of those outcomes. So if you bear that in mind, again, quite a stable return to work context. Lots of change in the composition of the Western Australian economy, alternative work for people exiting the workers' comp scheme. In the last few years, they'd be very confident of finding new employment of whatever kind. Less so now, so we're yet to see that have a major impact on our return to work rates. Claim payments rolled off the top of our payments. That's consistent with the overall trend. The seemingly inevitable growth in the total claim payments on an annual basis has ended last financial year, and it continues to fall marginally. That's quite an important aspect of our scheme as well. Our scheme is shrinking to a certain extent or declining in size, becoming much, much more about serious claims than the bulk of the claims which we've been used to focusing on. One of the key metrics which we use in our scheme, and of course, privately underwritten again, we have a profit component built into the cost structure of our scheme. How much of scheme payments and the scheme wherewithal goes to the benefit of workers is a key metric which we track all the time. And so it's hovered around 67, 66% pretty consistently. And some changes between the ratio of income payments and lump sums, and I'll talk about that in a moment. But that's a metric which receives a fair bit of attention in terms of the overall scheme design and the long-term performance of the scheme has validated the design in the sense that a healthy proportion, a defendable proportion of the scheme goes to the benefit of workers, which is the objective. Speaks a bit about the compensation focus of our scheme relative to return to work, the fact that we're interested in so much in that. Another key distinctive of the West Australian scheme is the access to settlements. So this has been a topic at various times about the benefits and virtues or otherwise of settlements. But effectively, in the West Australian scheme, you can settle a claim before the claim's accepted. There are techniques that can circumvent the six-month design feature that's in the Act. The Act presupposes that after 6 months of weekly payments, the claim can be settled. There is a common law mechanism by which the claim can be settled through a common law mechanism even before liability is accepted. So it's a very distinctive part. I don't think there's any other scheme would have such ready access to settlements in their design, either by design or by default or by accident, which is we've got a mixture of both. It's increasing very, very quickly in our scheme in recent years. A very high proportion of claims are settled by lump sum payments. And so this number we've quoted here is the percentage of all claims finalised by way of a lump sum. If you recut that and just had lost time claims, where there were lost time claims involved, it's about 25% of all claims are concluded by a settlement of some kind. There are permanent impairment settlement pathways. There is a memorandum of agreement to commute the claim in the common language of other schemes. And there's a common law pathway, which is known by its act reference, section 92F, done by the common law deed. And the combined impact of all of those has a very high proportion of our scheme is concluded there. Claims are concluded in that way. It couldn't keep continuing to increase at the rate it was increasing. It was quite alarming in terms of the proportion that claims were heading that way. Raises all sorts of questions. What happens to the worker once the settlement's obtained? Very clear answer I can give you. We don't know. And for many people involved in the design of workers' compensation schemes, that's a problem. It's not something which you'd aspire to, that you hand over some money and the worker goes away and you don't really care about their status. But effectively, not quite as bad as that, but we're pretty close to it. What I will say in a policy sense is the concerns about the rate of settlement and use of settlements in our scheme only emanated from WorkCover itself. Every other stakeholder thought they were fine. It's a good idea, including workers, certainly insurers, legal profession. Not surprisingly, they're involved in all of that, but it was quite an issue in our scheme a number of years back, but it has settled down simply because WorkCover stopped raising it because of the issues that the responses we were getting. We are planning to fine-tune it in our legislative, so-called legislative review, which is about to come someday soon. But that will really just regularise the current situation and provide another level of scrutiny on the agreements which are being reached. So quite an interesting point of view, and I've had lots of discussions, or a number of discussions with people over the last couple of days about that. And for site claims, I think on balance, it's the way to resolve a claim. The worker can exit the scheme pretty quickly, very quickly if that's what it takes. They can extract a lump sum from the guilty party in terms of the restorative justice sort of theme which is around. The other side pays, and they can move on with their life, because typically these claims are settled with an inclusion, not always, with an agreement to resign as well. So it's a big issue within our scheme, less so than it used to be because it stopped increasing, but quite an interesting part of the way in which the workers' compensation scheme works in Western Australia. Happy to take questions on that. Quick comparison again, just to labour the point that by the various metrics which are used in the CPM and other reports, we compare pretty favourably. The disputation rate is well worth noticing there, that 4% rate is well below the national average, and that's crept up a little bit in the past years. So it's been a bit lower, we're seeing a little bit of action there. But our resolution rate in dispute resolution is, in terms of timeliness, at 6 months. The benchmark that's used in CPM is pretty strong as well. I said to someone, I've been coming to the Actuaries Conference, or whatever it's been called, for probably 10 years, and I think for half of that I've been talking about our legislative review and the rewrite of our Act, which is just about to happen. And so I'm saying that again. Because we did a review in 2009, landed it in 2013, vigorous agreement from all stakeholders that it's a good thing and we should do it, still haven't got it underway. Simply because, for other reasons, our scheme is travelling pretty well and we've struggled to get drafting and parliamentary and political priority. That's still the case. There's still no major driver for change within our scheme. There are no major policy issues. There are many minor ones in terms of the way the Act is written and what actually happens on the ground relative to what the statute says. But we're still keen to do that rewrite, to do the modernising that brings our Act into the 20th century would be good, let alone the 21st. So early next year, will be the government's committed to reviewing the priority for that process, and we're looking to get good news and get drafting next year. We do have some action, legislative action, though, in terms of compensation for dependents of workers killed at work. One of the great virtues of the CPM report, the Safe Work Australia work, is that we regularly pull out the chart that shows how low our payment is to the dependents of workers who are killed at work. It's been shameful. It's been a long, long time where we are, I think we're the second lowest. I think ACT is planning to change it as well. Finally, we've got some action. A bit of a trade-off for not progressing with the major rewrite. The government committed to fixing this issue for dependents, which is a very positive thing. So we're increasing the lump sum, as you see. We're tying it to our other cap on statutory entitlement. So it's 2.5 times the statutory entitlement, maximum statutory entitlement, and a big increase for children and children in terms of their weekly allowances. So for those, anybody who's interested, we're following the Northern Territory model. So the Northern Territory model has a table of entitlements, which will sort out a lot of the angst and financial dependency challenges we've had in this area to date. It'd be very clear who gets what. Yeah, it's a pretty generous interpretation or rollout by the government. So financial dependency is no longer a factor. It's a straight-out entitlement based upon who you are and your relationship to the deceased worker and the other dependents in the pool. So a capped amount and divvied up between partners and children. As I say, very long time coming and very welcome across the board. Not very expensive and should have been done a long time ago. Just to finish off, we're very active. So we don't have much direct regulatory impact upon the providers, insurers, service providers, but we do have a very strong business intelligence and process monitoring routine that is built into the way in which we govern the scheme. So we count everything, we monitor everything, we report on everything to our board and to ourselves, and intervene where we see behaviours or outcomes which we don't like. And that soft regulation in the Malcolm Sparrow sort of sense is a very big part of the way in which our scheme works, and it's a very positive expression of how effective that can be, I think. So one thing we've talked about in past years that some of you might remember, the scheme viability report. So every quarter our board and our corporate executive gets a scheme viability report, which is based upon principles and measures. So any of the measures that change within the quarter are flagged, and any impact on scheme viability and performance are monitored and reported through. It's a very effective tool at a macro level, at a board level, to keep a track on what's happening within the scheme, as opposed to lots and lots of charts and stats and data. We also keep a close look on insurer viability. We rely upon APRA for the overall prudential requirements, but we do monitor their outcomes and their performance within our scheme. So what are we thinking about at the moment? We've spent the last couple of years thinking about the future of work. We've done an internal report. We've had some seminars. We ran a conference earlier this year in May, and a number of speakers talking about what does the world of work look like in the future and what might it mean for workers' compensation, and some of these things you've heard about already in different contexts. So the gig economy, the challenges involved in who's a worker, and I was saying to some that we should resurrect the definition of worker, working group, and start again. I think we've had 2 7-year goes at that in my time. But it's becoming real now, because there are so many new forms of employment which are on the fringes of the definition of a worker working, and I expect to see community pressures pretty soon from how these people should be treated. There'll be front newspapers of people who look awfully like workers who don't get any entitlements at all, and what should be the jurisdictional or the community response to that new form of working. Platform workers, the on-demand workers, are seeing everywhere. Independent contractors, there's been some talk, a number of presentations about ability for self-employed and independent contractors to opt into the workers' comp schemes and to pay their own premium and get the benefits of a structured set of entitlements versus the challenges of income protection and other forms of insurance. Our solution to this, such as it is to, when we rewrite the Act, is to give ourselves as much flexibility as possible. Our Act has so many things hard-coded in it that we cannot change. It's just not practical. So with the agreement of certainly our stakeholders and hopefully the parliamentary process, to move as much as we can, as much as is appropriate, to regulation that can be changed and modernised and tweaked as time goes by, including the capacity to add to the definition of a worker, so that we can include or exclude, provide clarity about that, the scope of that definition through regulation. That's our solution. That's on the that's our plan. What the policy decision's about, inclusions and exclusions and those sorts of issues, is work still yet to be done. But at the moment, it's too early to invest in that because we don't have the legislative platform in which to deliver it. Musculoskeletal injuries work cover WA hasn't been particularly active in the prevention area in Western Australia. There's a WorkSafe organisation, the safety regulator and the compensation, and we are two separate bodies. But we are progressively getting more involved as part of the national musculoskeletal strategy and target that's built into the national strategy. We're looking to work more collaboratively, provide some support to WorkCover, to WorkSafe, in addressing the enduring issue of musculoskeletal diseases. We hear a lot about psychological injuries, mental health claims, of course. It's a big challenge for us, but the heart and soul, the source of all, most of the costs in our schemes are musculoskeletal injuries, and we've brought it to a plateau of performance, and further improvements are going to be hard won. And but if schemes are to become more effective and reduce the impact on the community, musculoskeletal diseases must remain a priority and a focus of what we do. And I think I'll stop there. We publish a lot on our on the scheme performance on our web. We have a lot of metric data that's published on a quarterly basis on our scheme. Both actuarial and individual insurer performance is available to review. And so if you need any information, you can more than welcome to contact me, but there's a wealth of information on the website. And I'll stop there. Thank you. Oh, sorry, I bought some of our latest brochures. If you're interested in the scheme performance, there's a little pile there, and help yourself so I don't have to take them home.
All right, great. Thank you very much, Chris. Questions? There's a microphone in the centre if you'd like to make your way there.
Chris, I've got one. In the South Australian update, we heard Michael say that they're not seeing mental injury claims emerge in their numbers. They could well be hidden. I'm just curious about what might be emerging in WA.
There's a page on that in this wonderful publication, which I'll relate to. So we've had a reduction in 16-17. So, as Michael said in his presentation, it's largely a public sector issue, and Karen's here, she can verify that. It's from the Insurance Commission. But the upward trend seems to have plateaued out. WorkSafe has done a lot of prevention work and a lot of triaging work in terms of people who are facing bullying-type contexts at workplace. But the thing to remember, less than 3% of claims, 20% of disputes, more than 20% of disputes, and of course the average cost of a psychological claim is much, much higher. I don't know if it's here. Average cost is $70,000. So our overall lost time claim average is 41. So they're pretty expensive. Challenge for our dispute resolution teams to manage. A lot of wasted energy. Claims are settled in our scheme. There's a lot of angst, and the restorative justice aspect is something which I've become aware of, that often the aggrieved person in the claim wants the other side to pay, to acknowledge, and if they don't, to be penalised for it. And of course, the workers' comp scheme is not the vehicle to do that, but our lump sum mechanism has a bit of that to it, and they can see something with lots of zeros after it, and they can figure they've got that over the other side. And I think, just to repeat myself, an early exit from workers' comp schemes in the psychological context is a pretty positive outcome. Hopefully, though, the outcomes for the workers are sustainable. One thing I didn't mention in relation to settlements is we get very few ministerials or comebacks from workers with buyer's remorse who wish they'd never taken that settlement. So it's quite unusual, and I can count them on one hand how many we've had in recent times from workers who have taken these settlements, which I've talked about, and have regretted it, or at least have made it, regretted it to an extent to complain or to agitate for something, because there is no comeback, there is no way they can claim as being reopened, and we labour that point at the point of settlement too.
I've got one question, and it's really in and around, I suppose, the magnitude of those lump sums and whether you see them increasing over time, staying relatively level. Are they impacting, I suppose, if I come to the point you just made about the average cost of settlement claims, etc.?
The insurers would say they're just bringing costs forward, so they wouldn't do it if they didn't think it was in their interest to do it. And so the average size of lump sums has come down, but has stabilised in recent times. So, and they happen at all stages of claim development, but in our scheme, it very quickly turns to settlement, as is that where this claim is heading. The other thing to say is there's a lot of attention in every scheme about whole person impairment, getting those impairment scores right. It's less important in our scheme because it becomes a commercial settlement very quickly. They're not bound by their impairment score. So the worker goes to a worker-friendly doctor, gets a very high impairment score. Insurer or employer says, well, that's ridiculous. But they say, how about this amount of money? And the claim is resolved rather than battling out the impairment. We don't have those sorts of issues. We have an elaborate statutory process for resolving debates about impairment ratings. It's never been used. So, thank you.
Yes.
Well, we think it's a duration issue, but the economy has changed, so and we're planning to do some more work on that. So that is a real issue. So that we use a 60-day benchmark for declaring something to be a long-term claim, and that in absolute terms has gone up. So whilst the aggregate number of claims by almost every measure has gone down, that big rump is still there, and we think that it's more claims flipping long-term duration, not returning to work, and earning more than 60 days, rather than anything else in terms of structural change. But that's a body of work which some of our board is keen to pursue. Not much we can do about it. You know, in terms of, as the picture I've painted of our regulatory role, it's very hard to intervene in those sorts of things. We don't have any legislative or other measures to do. But we do try and work with WorkSafe on a prevention side, but also trying to identify the areas where communication and education would be beneficial.
Yeah, go ahead.
Chris, two questions and three of the last for colleagues from you. You talked about the very light touch legislative approach.
Yeah.
What effect does that approach have on the other scheme participants as to how they perform in the scheme? And second, quite a different part is you compared dispute outcomes in WA to the national average.
Yeah.
Could you expand further on why you think that difference is as large as it is?
So what was the first question? I'll focus on the last one. The relationship. So,
the light touch approach.
Yeah. So I've thought a lot about this because we are in marked contrast to many. We don't have any hint of adversarial relationship with our stakeholders. So I'm very well aware that we could be criticised as being captured and those sorts of things. I'm very sensitive to that. I don't think that's the case. We are very active in our stakeholder management and engagement. And we're not backward in calling someone in and saying, what do you think you're doing? And usually that gets the result that we're after. But it's a total package. There's a lot of love, but there's a lot of stern conversations that go together in that soft regulation type approach. And it can only work if it's an active approach. It's not passive. We don't wait for things. We monitor almost on a weekly basis on the outcomes of the previous week. Certainly I do. And when intervention's required, we do it.
I guess what I was getting at is if you can take the regulator panel,
yes,
what is that culture that you build in the scheme, what effect does that have on the other stakeholders? How do they operate?
Well, I think there's good collegiality between when problems emerge in the scheme. We've had there's any number of examples. Take asbestos. So we've got an elaborate process in our Act for paying mesothelioma claims, asbestos claims. Nobody observes it. So all the parties in the scheme have got together effectively by osmosis and worked out what's a fair process for dealing with these claims, and it just works. And so there's trust. There's no one applies the letter of the law. It would be very inconvenient if anybody does. And when there are problems with the Act, and we had a drafting defect back in 2012, everybody came together and said, OK, there's a problem. It's beneficial to one group. We all agreed that we would act as if it was properly drafted and on the undertaking that it would be fixed sooner rather than later. So very good relationships between parties on that basis and good communications. Fair degree of trust, self-interest reigns. I'm not painting a Pollyanna picture. Everyone's working for their own self-interest. That's always the case. But on balance, it works pretty well. Dispute resolution, I think, is pretty well designed. It's light touch, no documentation up front. You get conciliation within 3 weeks, cap of 8 weeks on conciliation, and then you go into formality. So there are incentives once you get into conciliation, but also we have internal, require the insurers to have internal dispute resolution processes which channel those issues through. And we do a lot of soft work in the background of where the dispute is really about communication. WorkCover will, through our advisory service, step in and make some of that happen.
Okay, and on that note, I don't want to hold you up from afternoon tea, so we'll leave it there. If you could all like to thank Chris White one more time.